No, Yasmina gasped, and then to her husband. Timothy, for God's sake! Timothy! Timothy! She could not have him taken to A&E. If that happened, it would all come to light. His usage, his cadging pills from his patients, his full addiction. She said to Sati, It's all right, darling. He's just having trouble. He'll be all right, see? Sati, look, he's coming round now.
And he was, thank God. His eyelids fluttered. He closed them. She slapped him hard. He opened them. She jerked him to a sitting position, then to his feet. She said,
See, Sati, he's up. He'll be fine. He took a pill last night to help him sleep. I'm taking him into the bathroom now. We'll need to be private, but he's all right, see?
Sati looked stricken. Yasmina felt fury whipping through her body. It seemed to give her superhuman strength. She reckoned she could carry Timothy if she had to, but she didn't have to. He said, Sati, although his head hung low, I'll be... And he sagged into Yasmina. But he'd said enough. So Sati backed into the corridor, her fists bunched beneath her chin as Yasmina got Timothy into the bathroom. She glanced back at her daughter before she shut the door.
I'm so sorry, Yasmina said. Sati, darling, I'm so sorry.
Ludlow, Shropshire. She was provoking in at least half a dozen ways. But Linley knew that when it came to her considerations about a case, Barbara Havers could be absolutely trusted. So when they'd carried on their post-churchyard conversation as they walked back to Griffith Hall on the previous night, he'd listened to what she had to say once they were in agreement over the various screws, bolts and spanners that were being thrown into the workings of their investigation.
She'd begun with, Trouble is, she's too tall, sir.
Francie A-D-A-M-U-C-C-I, as she terms herself.
The very same. They're both blonde, and they've both got that college girl in need of a decent hairstyle thing going on.
To which he lifted an eyebrow, and she went on with,
All right, I know, who am I to talk, eh? But you know what I mean. All these girls are walking round like refugees from the 1960s. All they need is wreaths of flowers and tickets to San Francisco or whatever. My point is that, despite both of them being blonde, that's where the resemblance ends. Their body types are completely different. The girl I saw with Raddick was short. I could compare her height to the door of the car since she was standing next to it. This girl, Francie, willowy, tall, bosomy, whatever. You know what I mean. Your basic nightmare for the rest of womankind. Now, I know it was dark, but when the girl I saw got out of the car, the light went on and I clocked her face, and it wasn't that girl.
At which point she jerked her thumb in the direction from which they'd walked.
And anyway, there's the fact of the patrol car in the first place.
That Dina Donaldson brought up the patrol car when you'd only said a car, full stop.
That means something. And what it means is that she's been with Raddick. So you ask me, someone's not giving us all the facts. Dina, Francie A-D-A-M, etc., or even Harry Rochester, who might have seen Dina, but who's now pretending he saw Francie for some reason. You see that, don't you?
What Linley saw was that time was running out, and soon Hillier was going to be demanding a result that wouldn't put the lot of them into the boiling water in the Home Secretary's office. So he said before they'd reached the hotel, When it comes to giving us all the facts, Sergeant, I dare say it's more than one someone. I'll ring and Carter in the morning. Which he did, as soon as he was certain the other detective sergeant would be at his desk. When he heard in Carter's distinctive voice, that blend of West African and the Caribbean via Brixton, he said, Might I call upon your research skills, Winston? We've a bit of a muddle up here.
Say what? Was Winston's friendly reply.
Linley gave him a list of names, at the top of which was Harry Rochester, and at the bottom of which was Christopher Spencer, the inclusion of whom was largely the result of desperation. At the end, Carter whistled.
That's going to require some time. What am I looking for?
Anything in their pasts that seems dodgy. Just now we're most interested in Harry Rochester, but if any of the rest of them have sneezed without covering their mouths, let us know. Can you fit this in today?
Can do. I got a bit of other research going on, but that'll...
He stopped, because as Linley heard, someone was speaking to him. He said to that person,
Yeah, it is. He just gave me a bell.
And then into the phone again,
D. Harriman wants a word, Inspector.
When he heard her voice saying,
This is like divine intervention, Detective Inspector Linley.
Linley responded with what he considered great loyalty. As far as I can tell from her general level of exhaustion in the morning, Barbara's practicing nightly, D., Or perhaps she's doing it before breakfast. I admit to not asking her exactly when she's channeling Ginger Rogers, but she's apparently wearing her metatarsals, or is it her phalanges, down to the bone. But wait, do forgive me. In either case, those are bones, aren't they? At any rate, she's intent upon turning in a stellar performance at the dance recital, and do make sure I have the date in my diary, because despite her every threat, I intend to be there. Dee said, I fully expect you, so if you're joking... I dare not joke about an opportunity to see Sergeant Havers in tap shoes, believe me. She laughed and said, It's going to be brilliant. You'll see. She's going to be brilliant, but that's not why I wanted to have a word.
Ah, the divine intervention meant what, then?
There was a moment's pause. Then Dee spoke sotto voce, and it seemed she'd moved away from Ancarta's desk, or at least turned her back on the Diaz. She said,
She rang in again. Ill, she said. She's never ill, Detective Inspector. What should I do?
DCS Ardrey.
Who else?
Perhaps it's better to say she's never been ill before now, Dee. He made his voice easy, but worry tightened his fingers on his mobile. And now she is.
What should I do? You haven't said.
Have you spoken to her?
She left a message. Again. But someone's going to ring her. At any moment, Detective Inspector. Or someone's going to ring me and ask about her, and I don't quite know what to say. Or what I should do. Perhaps if you rang her. I'm that concerned, you see. You're going to say that I shouldn't be, or that it's not down to me if she's ill or whatever, but if you could hear how she sounds on the phone. And it seems to me... You know. I mean, am I meant to come out and tell you what I think, Detective Inspector Linley?
What is it, you think?
You know. I know that you know because there have been times when voices carry, even if the door is shut, and I don't intend to eavesdrop, and it's not like I'm even doing it at all, and I've also seen you waiting outside her office door and listening and—
Dee?
Sir?
Linley considered what he wanted to tell her. Dee Harriman's loyalties ran deep and in all directions, including towards Isabel Ardrey. Because of this, Linley knew she meant well. He said, We're without power here.
Right. Yes, but I thought if she knew that other people know, I mean, although I suppose she knows that at least you know, doesn't she?
And what good do you see that doing? In her pause, he heard other voices in the background. The day was in full swing in London. Dee wasn't wrong in her concern, as someone was going to have to take matters in hand eventually, but it wasn't going to be Thomas Linley. It couldn't be. Nor could it be Dorothea Harriman. She said,
None, I suppose. So I... Do what, exactly?
You know the answer to that.
God, I'm not meant to report her, am I?
You're meant to do your job, he told her. She's left you a message that tells you she's ill. You believe she isn't, and you may well be right. But as you don't know, and as she hasn't told you, she's not going to tell me she's having a morning after, or she's currently too addled to show her face round here. All you can do is merely report what you've been told, if and when you're asked.
And if I'm not asked?
I think you know the answer to that.
But this can't go on, Detective Inspector.
It won't go on. These things never do. They rang off, then. Linley had been sitting on the edge of his prison cell bed as he made the call, and now he looked down at his shoes. They wanted a serious polishing, he noted. Unfortunately, he'd brought no polish with him, although, even if he had done, he doubted he'd do a job on them acceptable to Charlie Denton. He considered ringing him just to inquire how the Mamet was going, and then he considered ringing Deirdre. But she had deep concerns of her own, her birth parents and her siblings, and her mother's final journey. Still, he wondered what it meant that he hadn't heard from her, that, thrust back into a world she'd believed she'd left forever, she was now confronting her worst memories without him. He was forced to ask himself why she didn't need him in a moment like this. He went on to ask himself the obvious. Did people actually need each other at all? He couldn't answer that question, so he didn't try. Ludlow, Shropshire. When Ding awakened, she was alone in her bed, as she'd been all night. This constituted one of the very few times she'd been alone in however long it had been, because she couldn't actually remember, but it must have been 2 weeks after autumn term had begun, since that was when she first hooked up with Brutus. And although he'd begun doing it with other girls within 5 weeks or so from the start of term, he'd ended up in her bed nonetheless, save for the nights when she'd refused him from sheer outrage that he was so completely Brutus about everything. She'd also not had sex with Finn, or with anyone, on the previous day, or during the previous night. That was certainly not impressive, but what was impressive was that she'd been able to go to sleep and then wake up without being in a twist about it. In the past, she would have become instantly consumed with a question of who she was going to be with next, as if being with someone, which, let's face it, was always a euphemism for fucking them, had something to do with who she really was. She still had very little idea of that, who she really was. But at least she could now trace a path from the child she'd been to the adolescent and then the young adult she'd become. In this, she saw that she'd always been running. She hadn't known why, but she'd always felt like someone quite desperate to get to a destination that she couldn't identify. And because she couldn't identify the destination she was actually seeking, let alone recognize it when she arrived, she'd ended up seeking the one that was most familiar to her over and over again, even if she hadn't known why it was familiar to her in the first place. When she saw her father's naked, dead body, she thought, she must have decided at some level that everything he was in that terrible moment had to do with that thing between his legs. In that moment of seeing him, dead and naked, she must have reached a conclusion of some kind, because that was the only way she could explain to herself the disgust she felt each time some bloke let her know how important it was to him to have her do something, anything, really, that involved his penis. So, she thought as she lay in bed with her gaze upon her bedroom ceiling, if that was the case, where was her true fury coming from, especially the fury she felt towards Brutus and the various girls he'd snogged with, bonked, or been blown by since she'd known him? She'd held them in contempt as well, but where did that come from, and what did it mean? She considered this, and the answer dawned on her slowly, but oh so visually that she knew at once what it was about. She could see their faces when they were with him, Alison, Monica, Francie. She could see what played on their features, and she knew what it was. Enjoyment, pleasure, whatever you wanted to call it, but it was something she herself could not feel. That's what it was. Alison giggling, Monica looking like a satisfied cat, Francie inviting her to join in the fun, because it was fun to Francie, and it always had been, whereas to Ding, she'd fucked them, or sucked them, or wanked them while waiting, just waiting for when she could tell herself that only she saw what a miserable creature the male of Homo sapiens was. She got out of bed. She rooted round in a drawer till she found clothing she could have worn for yoga, but instead wore to slop round the house. Once she donned it, she left her room. Finn's door was closed. Brutus's was also. She approached the latter and knocked. "Bro," she called. "Can I have a word?" She heard a bit of muffled conversation, but that was it, so she said, "It's not a big thing, Brew. No worries, Kay." That seemed to do it. She heard bed springs creak, and then in a moment Brutus opened the door. The fact that he sheltered the inside of his room from her view told her that he probably had a new girl with him. He slid into the corridor and shut the door behind him, saying, "Yeah? What?" He sounded wary. He gave a look in the direction of Finn's room and then back at her. She saw he'd put on boxer shorts, but nothing else. "Can I talk to you?" she said. "It won't take long. Can you come to my room for a minute?" "You and me aren't..." "It's not about us," she cut in quickly. "We both know that there isn't an us anyway. But I got to ask you something, and it's better inside." She tilted her head towards her bedroom. He said with an obvious attempt at patience, "Ding, I explained things over and over. There's no more ways to explain it to you."
"It's not about that. There's one thing you never tried to explain because I never asked, and that's what I want to talk about. But like I said, it won't take long."
He sighed and said, "Okay. But wait a second." He ducked back into his room, more like a slither so he could get in without opening the door more than 10 inches, and in a moment Ding could hear the murmur of voices, his and a girl's. She felt the hurt of the unnamed girl's presence, but she understood that what she felt was not about Brutus, but rather about herself, which it had been from the first. When he came out again, he was wearing jeans and a T-shirt. He followed her to her room and remained inside by the door. She said,
"It's not like I'm going to jump you or anything."
He said, "Oh, no, but I needed to tell her." "Got it." She realized as she spoke that it didn't matter. Who the girl was, why she was there, what they'd done together, none of it truly and actually mattered. She said,
"It's okay and everything, Brew. I get it now. We're not so different, you and me. We come at things different, but that's all it is."
"Right." If anything, he looked even warier. She said,
"Anyway, it's not about that. I got to ask you something about last year, in December. That night it snowed bad and we got so pissed at the Hart and Hind."
He frowned.
It snowed lots of nights. And we got pissed lots of nights.
Right, but it's that night we went to the Hart and Hind with the plan, you and me. We drank cider instead of lager. It's that night, Brutus.
She waited for recognition to dawn. When it didn't, she said,
Only the thing was that we didn't plan it to be as bad as it got. Finn was there as well, but he was drinking Guinness while the rest of us stuck with cider. And you remember how we got wrecked? We didn't intend to, you and me at least, but that's what happened.
He nodded slowly.
I remember.
Yeah, that was dead stupid, wasn't it? It was worse than stupid. It was really bad. I mean, it got really bad. That's why things have been like they've been.
What things?
Ding, you're not making any sense. I haven't said anything to anyone, but now I need to know. My mind's been totally destroyed for ages, and I'm trying to straighten it out, so what I want to know is where you were. See, I woke up that night and you weren't here, and like you said, you always spent the night with me if we, you know, if we did it at night and not during the day or whatever. Only that night I woke up and you weren't here and you never came back. Where were you?
He still looked confused, as if wondering why all these months later she would want to know something so meaningless. But he said,
I was hugging the loo.
What?
I got up to pee, only I was bloody dizzy and then I started feeling like I was going to sick up on the floor. I made it to the loo and we got seriously acquainted, me and it, and I must have blacked out because I remember thinking I'd just rest a sec on the bathroom floor in front of the loo, and next thing I knew, Finn was pissing over my head. And it wasn't completely over my head. You know, Finn. Anyway, he holds the drink better than I do, and he wasn't drinking cider in the first place.
Ding raised her fingers to her lips.
The bathroom, she said. You were in the bathroom that night when I woke up?
Till Finn showed, yeah. But by then it was light outside, and I went to my room, and that was it.
Ding, what the hell's going on?
She shook her head because she wasn't sure. She thought she had been, but the ground had shifted, and she had to think what she was meant to do. Ludlow, Shropshire.
Straight from the first, when I was here with the DCS, that bloke's laid out half-truths, sir. He's left out details, and he's painted things this way first and that way later. Then it's been, oh, did I forget to mention my assortment of phone calls to the husband of the Deputy Chief Constable and to Ian Druitt as well? And, oh, yes, indeed-o, I'm acquainted with Finnegan Freeman, and did I not ever mention that Mr. Druitt had concerns about him? And I'm also rather more than acquainted with a girl who just happens to live in the same house with Finnegan.
Barbara and Linley had taken themselves onto the hotel terrace, where the coolness of the morning precluded anyone deciding to breakfast al fresco. Nor were they doing so. But daily more visitors were arriving in Ludlow, and daily Griffith Hall was housing them. Linley had quietly told Barbara about his phone call to Encarta, and she wanted him to ring the DS another time and add Gary Ruddock to his list. Once she'd begun to argue this point, Linley had taken her out to the terrace. Now they stood above the lawn and out of view of both the breakfast room and the lounge. Two gardeners were working among the shrubbery and the flowers, but they were at a distance, so the conversation between Barbara and her superior could go unheard. Linley was being too meditative by half. He appeared to be inspecting the work of the gardeners as if comparing it to whatever maintenance went on at the massive property in the Lord Asherton side of his life. She wanted him to swing into action, although she herself couldn't have said what that action was going to be. She said,
"Sir? Earth to Inspector Linley? Ludlow on the line?"
He stirred. "I don't disagree in the least with the list of curiosities to which—"
"Curiosities?
You're referring. But the fact remains that despite everything we've seen and heard, some of which is admittedly questionable—"
"Questionable?
I think you'll agree that absolutely nothing amounts to a motive for anyone doing anything. And—" he raised his hand to keep her from interrupting again— "while I agree that motiveless suicide is on the list, as well as motiveless murder and motiveless anything else, you must admit that that's damned strange, despite the nature of what's occurred."
"Those 19 days, you mean?"
"Among other things, but yes."
"So?"
She tried to sound encouraging. "We know there's more here than meets the eye, which is another reason to see what Encarta can dig up. But the problem remains what it was from the first, Barbara. We have no witness to anything save Officer Ruddock fetching binge drinkers somewhere, probably to their respective homes, and I don't need to mention that we have no conclusive evidence of anything else."
"And isn't that curious?
Not Raddock and the Bingers. I mean having no witnesses to those other things, such as having a witness via film to whoever made the phone call that got Ian Druitt carted to the Nick in the first place. Isn't it just too bloody convenient that the camera's position was switched so it wouldn't record the anonymous caller? And isn't it even more convenient that the camera itself was turned off for 20 seconds, which happens to be quite enough time for someone to get outside and move the camera's position and get back inside to turn it back on? Who the hell would you say is the likeliest suspect here?
Again, you won't find me disagreeing, although we have to take on board the fact that dozens of people have access to that station, and those dozens include virtually every individual serving on the West Mercia police force. What time was that phone call made?
Round midnight.
So do you actually see Officer Ruddock, who could have done the camera switching and the phone call at any time, getting up in the dead of night to trek over to the station to do it, when all he really had to do was make sure he was alone in the station, which he apparently is most of the time, and then to do what needed to be done with the camera and the anonymous call?
Unless, she said, he wants to make it look like he's being framed.
There's that, admittedly, he noted. But my point is that, there again, we've nothing at all that leads us to that conclusion.
So we've come on a fool's errand, is that it?
Out on the lawn, one of the gardeners had started a mower and was now heading towards them. The other had begun spraying something on a climbing rose that was spilling blooms over the farthest corner of the garden wall. Linley directed her off the terrace and towards Ludlow Castle, but they paused on the pavement across the street from the ruins to continue their discussion. He said, I'm not positing that, but you know what the problem is as well as I do. It's impossible to commit the perfect murder. There's always going to be evidence at some point, unless somehow the murder manages to pose convincingly as a death so natural that there's no question about it. That being the case, I'm talking about the possibility of carrying out the perfect murder, if there is no evidence that this was murder, then the conclusion is the one originally reached. As regrettable as it seems, it was suicide.
You actually believe that?
Barbara, I agree that the PCSO looks questionable. But the operative word, as you well know, is looks, and unless we come up with something beyond how things look, we're left with a great deal of finger-pointing and nothing else, and we're also left with being recalled to London, which I dare say is going to happen sooner rather than later. She kicked at a small clump of weeds that was growing from a crack between the pavement stones. She muttered, "Whatever," as she did so. But then she was struck by a sudden thought. So she looked up and said,
"We're also left with manoeuvring, sir."
Believe me, I haven't discounted that. But I'm not convinced we're at that point yet. Over at the castle, someone was on the closest battlement arranging a flag that unfurled to advertise the coming Shakespeare festival on the castle grounds. Titus Andronicus was on the menu. Linley glanced at this and said, Good Lord. Barbara said,
What?
Rape, chopping off hands, cutting a tongue from a mouth, baking dead men into pies. You've not got there yet?
I'm only doing tragedies. Is that one of them?
That it's being produced at all, yes. Barbara laughed in spite of herself. She said,
What about Francie Adamucci, then? She made it clear she wants Ruddock looked at. Could be that's at the bottom of what's been going on round here. Ruddock, drunken college students, trips to the Nick for some of them, or at least trips to the Nick's car park. Could be our Gaz doesn't have any special bird he's bonking, and is too noble to name. Could be he's collecting the bingers, taking them home, but each time saving one at the end to take to the car park instead.
Why would she, I assume you mean that the one he takes to the car park is female, go with him?
Could be she doesn't want to be carted home for some reason. Trouble with Mummy and Dad comes to mind straight off. Although I suppose it could be trouble with a tutor at the college, trouble with a housemate, trouble with anyone about anything. And could be that the trouble's avoided with a little bit of whatever our Gaz happens to fancy inside the patrol car.
Where does that take us, Barbara?
To the first explanation of what's questionable about him. Everything else has been iffy but straightforward, meeting some woman he doesn't want to name for the sake of honour. Didn't that have a nice ring to it? Having on with her the night Druitt died, dereliction of duty, and Gaz falling on his sword like Sir Lancelot and whatever.
Lancelot didn't.
Oh, I bloody know that. Point is, he paints himself as nobility made flesh, when all along could be he's forcing college girls to have sex with him when they're drunk, and that's not so straightforward. True that we need one of those girls to go on record. But in the meantime, back to manoeuvring. I say we let him think one of them has.
And if we do that, where does it get us?
Barbara considered it.
Where the possibility of Ruddock, drunken college girls, and the Nick's car park could lead. Then she had it. She said,
Holy hell in a bun, sir. It gets us to a college girl spilling the beans to a man of God. It gets us to that man of God deciding that having a word with Ruddock about what he's been up to is in order. It gets us to Ruddock deciding to do something about it before Druitt takes his word-having to another level, such as to Ruddock's superiors. We've got that Lomax girl meeting with Druitt, sir.
You can't be suggesting it would take her 7 sessions with Druitt to get round to telling him that Ruddock is having his way with young women in his patrol car.
But if she's one of the girls...
Just think about it, Barbara. Isn't the solution to being one of the girls merely to stop binge drinking? Or to binge indoors if binging's on the agenda?
If that's how and why he's collecting them, sir.
And if he's collecting them in the first place, because no one's being forthright about that.
Harry Rochester is.
Harry Rochester merely saw the PCSO with young people, some of them young women, who seemed to be drunk, full stop. You do see the problem, don't you? She looked to the castle again. On the battlements another banner was being unfurled. The importance of being earnest. Linley saw this as well and murmured, hardly an antidote to the other, but at least it's a start. And then to her, well, she knew he wasn't referring to Oscar Wilde. She said,
we're dead in the water without proof.
Even if we like the scenario of Ruddock and a college girl, we're overlooking any number of salient details to get there.
I see that, she admitted. Like, where do the Freemans fit in? Like, why the phone calls between Druitt and Ruddock? Like, why's Ruddock been asked to keep an eye on Finnegan, and is that even relevant? Like, why the gap in time to bring Druitt in for questioning once the anonymous paedophilia message happened? Like...
What, sir? Linley had snapped his fingers. He answered her with, we've been absolute fools, Barbara.
About what? Why?
About the 19 days, and what they've been telling us.
Which is what?
That Ruddock had to be the one to make the arrest of Druitt, and that could only happen if the Shrewsbury patrol officers, whose job it otherwise would have been, were involved elsewhere, and that took 19 days to occur.
So Ruddock was waiting for those blokes to be involved somewhere else, like dealing with a string of burglaries?
Linley shook his head. Not at all, he said. Follow the breadcrumbs, Barbara. It's never been Ruddock who was doing the waiting. Ludlow, Shropshire. On the previous night, Trevor had done something that he'd not done in years. He'd gone down the pub and had too much to drink. Chloe hadn't been at home for dinner, ringing to tell him she had a late meeting, so he'd decided the hell with making himself a meal, and at the pub he ordered fried scampi and peas with a hearty pile of chips. He swilled a pint of lager to wash the meal down, and when he'd finished it, he ordered another. Ultimately, he'd had 4. He topped off his evening with 2 fingers of Jameson, after which he went home to find Clover in the kitchen, opening several days' post. When he walked in, she gave him a look and said,
I hope someone drove you home.
He went to the table and stood before her. He gave her a mock salute. Good little soldier checking in, he told her. Scotland Yard showed up and I told them the tale. All's right in the world.
I don't much like you when you're drunk, Trev. If you want to talk about this...
Didn't say that, did I? And he took himself off to bed. He went to Finn's bedroom. There on the single bed he'd spent the night. In the morning she was already gone when he rose, which he'd reckoned was just as well. He had things to see to, and he didn't want one of them to be another attempt at wrenching information from his wife. He drove straight to Ludlow. His conversation with Gaz Ruddock didn't need to be a long one, he decided, but it needed to happen. So once he arrived in town, he rang the PCSO's mobile to locate him. He'd appreciate a word, was how Trevor put it. He added the information that he was in Ludlow, so he could easily meet up with the PCSO where and when Gaz could. Gaz sounded surprised that Trevor was there in town, but he didn't ask for an explanation. Instead, he said that he was doing his usual walkabout, having a stroll from the superstore on Station Drive. He'd be taking in the railway station and heading on past the library to the Bullring. Did Trevor want to meet him along the way? That would be fine, Trevor told him. He was just at the police station, and the Bullring wasn't far from there. He would see Gaz soon. Their conversation could have been handled over the phone, but Trevor wanted to see Gaz in person. So once their plan to meet was laid, he set off up Lower Guldeford in the direction of Tower Street. This would take him to the Bullring, where just beyond it stood Ludlow's pictorial claim to fame, the fanciful, multi-gabled, multi-level, multi-windowed structure called the Feathers Inn. As usual, the inn was doing its bit as the subject of photographs, for its balcony displayed containers trailing vines and flowers, and its leaded diamond panes caught the sunlight. Here was where Trevor saw Gaz Ruddock, posing cooperatively with a group of tourists. It was likely, although he wasn't clothed and helmeted as such, they assumed he was a traditional and now non-existent English bobby on the beat. Gaz saw him and grinned, giving a shrug that asked, "What can one do?" Trevor waited till the picture-taking was completed, at which juncture the tourists moved off to follow their flag-bearing leader, fixing earphones on their heads. He joined Gaz and said, "Where next?" To which the PCSO said, "Mill Street by way of Brand Lane and Bell Lane. But I can wait if you fancy something. Coffee or whatever. But at the Bull," he gestured across to that hostelry with its inn yard into which coaches once had set down their passengers. "Not here." Trevor didn't want anything to eat or to drink, but he also wanted to be able to see Gaz's face as he spoke to him. That couldn't be accomplished if they were walking side by side, so he agreed. The Bull was fine. The hour was such that the only people in the bar area were a college professor type, at least by his garb, and three younger people whom Trevor took for students. They were huddled in a far corner, engaged in an avid conversation. They didn't even take note of anyone else entering the place. Trevor demurred on the coffee, but Ruddock fetched himself one. While he was doing so, Trevor decided upon a table where the light was best. There were stools, not chairs, so it wasn't going to be a comfortable spot to perch, but he didn't intend to be there long. "Finswell?" Gaz set his coffee on the table and dumped milk into it. He stirred it carefully, as if with concern that he might slosh the brew out of the cup should he apply the spoon too energetically. "Not as well as I'd like. Scotland Yard burst in on him yesterday morning." Gaz frowned. "They got bees in their knickers, that lot. You want me to have a word with Finn? I can let him know he's not the only person they're paying calls on, so he's not to worry." Trevor studied Gaz. He had such an innocent face. It was either his natural expression, not to mention his very nature, or he'd become quite good at projecting it. He would need the earnestness, naturally. That had served him well at the training school, and would be even more necessary to his future after the death at the Ludlow station. But it could also serve interests other than professional. Trevor didn't want to forget that for a moment. He said, "You won't need to do that. Finn's handling it. He was a bit cut up when they showed up in his bedroom." "What the hell?" "Right, it was a definite shocker and designed to be that way. But Finn's past it now. I told him I'd have a word, and I intend to do."
"Does Clo know about this?"
"Why do you ask?" Gaz drew his eyebrows together. He seemed surprised at the question, as if the answer should be obvious.
"She outranks the two who came. Seems like she could do something about it if they show up in her son's bedroom, like give a bell to London or whatever."
"Ah," Trevor said. "Yes, she does have that power. I'm surprised you were never put off by that. Most blokes in your position would take quite some patch of time to get to know a superior officer, but that wasn't a problem for you."
"I got to know them all, is what it is, Trev. I mean all the higher-ups who gave courses at the training centre."
"You definitely got to know Clover," Trevor remarked. "Least, that's what all the phone calls from my mobile suggest. You went back and forth a lot, you two."
"Like I told you, it was Finn."
"Yes, like you told me." Trevor gave him what he intended to be an avuncular look. He wasn't sure it was coming off as such, because he didn't feel the least avuncular at the moment, but it was time to put the full stop in place. So he said, "We can call that off now, Gaz."
"What?"
"You're watching over Finn and reporting back to his mum."
"Does Clo not want me to do it any longer?"
"I'm sure she does. If she could, she'd have someone watching over Finn into his dotage. I'm the one putting an end to things. Finn's doing fine, so you can let him sort out his life on his own." Gaz looked at his coffee. A muscle moved slightly at the back of his jaw. He finally said,
"If that's how you want it, Trev."
"It's definitely how I want it," Trevor told him. "Finn wants it as well, and I'm sure once I tell Clover she'll agree it's for the best. No lad, well, I should actually say no young man, shouldn't I, wants his mum assigning him a guardian angel.
Or a guardian, or a guard. As for the rest, let's keep things as they are. You're something of a friend of the family at this point, after all."
Gaz looked up.
"Hope I am. You're that important to me, Trev, all of you."
Trevor smiled. "Beyond everything else, Gaz? I know that we are." Ludlow, Shropshire. Ding walked in the direction of the Ludford Bridge. her footsteps not quite as quick as they should have been, considering she was on her way to a tutorial and knowing that even if she jogged there she was going to be late, and Greta Yates was probably going to hear about it. But she couldn't make herself go at a faster pace because she was caught up in a combination of thought and memory, reaching conclusions that made her more uneasy than she'd been in months. She finally understood that she'd been taken in by Finn Freeman. So had everyone else. The truth was that despite using him to get at Brutus, she'd actually not given much thought to Finn, aside from his inept approach as a lover. But now she saw that Finn's ineptness had always been a clue to who he was, and she'd missed it. So she understood what she wasn't intended to understand or even to know. The problem was, she hadn't the first clue what to do about it. She was considering this as she crossed the Ludford Bridge in the direction of the Charlton Arms. The Breadwalk was her chosen route, rising a good distance above the river just beyond the Free House. This would take her quickly to Dinham Street, where her tutor held sessions with students in a former chapel that was now his house. She was scurrying along when she heard her name called. It came from in front of her, and she saw that the caller was Chelsea Lloyd, of all people. Since, as far as she knew, Chelsea never got out of bed before 10 in the morning and had made sure all of her lectures and tutorials reflected this, Ding knew something was up. Chelsea hurried towards her.
"Thank goodness," she said. "I was waiting outside Mr. McMurray's house. Did you know there was a bloke sleeping rough under it? It's got this open area that was part of a crypt or something, and—"
"Were you waiting for me?" "Why?" Ding cut in. "I'm late, so I got to walk fast, Chels."
"Oh, right, yes."
Chelsea hurried along at Ding's side.
"Francie wanted me to talk to you. She told me she tried to explain the Brutus thing, but that you didn't want to understand. God, are you in good shape or what? Can you slow down? I can barely breathe. Anyway, she's ever so sorry about Brutus, Ding. It's just how she is, you know? She just larks about, doesn't she? And it's not like you ever gave us a clue that Brutus meant something to you more than, you know, he doesn't."
"Oh.
Can we slow down? I'm already late, Chels, and I'm in trouble with the college anyway, so I got to get there. Was Brutus what she wanted you to talk to me about? Because if it is, you can tell her he doesn't mean anything to me. He did, obviously, but now he doesn't. The coast is clear, or whatever. Can I tell her you don't want to scratch her eyes out any longer? You can tell her whatever you want. Was that the message?"
"Oof."
Chelsea was breathing hard. "I've got to take up jogging or something. Anyway, no, that wasn't. I mean, it wasn't the message."
She had to drop behind when the path narrowed, shrubs and weeds growing thickly in an area that allowed more sun. But she didn't stop talking.
"She wants you to know the cops pinned her down last night. It was about Gaz Ruddock. They told her she got pointed out as someone who'd been seen with him."
"So? That doesn't exactly surprise me. It's not like she hasn't been with practically everyone, let's face it."
"Right, yeah."
Chelsea hustled to catch Ding up. The river below them glittered in the sunlight. Birds soared out of the trees in the direction of the bridge, chirruping happily.
"But she hasn't ever been with him like you've been with him, if you know what I mean. He tried it with her, but you know, Francie, nothing puts the frighteners on her. And anyway, her parents know about everything she does, the drinking and the blokes and doing stuff with them. They've sort of washed their hair of her. So really, where did he think that was going to get him? Except, obviously, he doesn't know her. Or he didn't know her. And anyway, that was, when? Last October?"
Ding did slow up then. Indeed, she stopped for a moment. Hand on her hip, she asked,
"Is there a point to this, Chels?"
"Well, there is. See, thing is that the last thing in the world Francie wants to be is anyone's bit of fun. I know, you know that already, but the thing is, the cops kept pressing her, and she lost it a bit."
Ding resumed her pace. No matter what this inane conversation was about, she needed to get to her tutorial. She said,
"Okay, got it, she lost it." "Right, and when she lost it, she sort of told the cops to talk to you if they wanted the real story on Gaz Ruddock."
Ding's legs went to jelly. She turned to Chelsea.
"Why did she say that? Chelsea, that puts me straight in things, it does. Like I said, she lost it. She got caught up in stuff. And that's what cops do, don't they? They get you caught up. Look, she feels dead awful that she even mentioned your name to them, but she wanted you to know. And she did say something like how we'd all be dead chuffed if someone did something about Ruddock. And that sort of misdirects, doesn't it? I mean, it takes them away from thinking about you. They probably don't even remember she said your name, right? And it's not like she made something up or anything."
Strength returned to her legs, and Ding swung back to the path, saying,
"That just makes me feel so much better knowing she didn't make something up. She's sorry, Ding. Really, she's sorry. She asked me to tell you as soon as I could, which, you see, is what I'm doing. She wanted to warn you and to give you a chance."
"For what, exactly?"
"I don't know. But I think she wanted to give you a chance to plan what to say. About Gaz Ruddock.
and everything else.
Ludlow, Shropshire. When Linley knocked upon the door to the room that Barbara Havers had been assigned, the last thing he expected to hear from the sergeant as she opened it was, "I'm sorry, really, I did try to hand it off to you, Inspector, remember?" before she admitted him. As she stepped back from the door, he saw the cause of her embarrassment. A sitting room, a sofa, two chairs, a coffee table, and beyond that a bedroom with an ensuite, into which he guessed, since he could not see it at the moment, his entire room could have fit. He took all this in and said to her, "You do know you now have absolutely no excuse for not practising, Sergeant."
"Oh, God, don't tell her! Here, look!"
She dumped an overnight case onto the sofa and excavated through its contents to bring forth a pair of red tap shoes.
"See?
I'm unconvinced. They look remarkably unworn."
"They aren't. I swear, every night I've been at it. Whoever's below me, I expect they think woodpeckers have invaded the building."
She threw the shoes in the general direction of the rest of her belongings and said,
"I've cleared the bed."
"I rest assured. Let's see what we have." Linley reached for his spectacles in his jacket pocket. On the bed he divided in half the reports and the photographs. Together he and Havers began to lay them out. He remarked as they did so, "I think what we failed to see is that this was about getting individuals, in the plural, mind you, out of the way. One of them needed to be got out of the way permanently.
Druitt,
while the other, Ruddock, needed to be temporarily out of commission in whatever way that could be made to happen. The IPCC looked at Druitt's suicide that night in the Ludlow station and at what occurred in the aftermath to deal with the death. Your investigation with Isabel, with the DCS, looked at that as well as delving round Ian Druitt's life and times to see if someone might have wanted to eliminate him. Anonymous phone calls, allegations of paedophilia, diaries, meetings with various people. You asked yourselves what he did, whom he knew and why he needed to be done away with, if, in reality, he wasn't actually a suicide. You and I have taken things further, but not far enough, because what we haven't considered is both of them together. Ruddock and Druitt."
"Druitt needing to be brought into the station," Havers said, "but only if it could be managed that Ruddock was the one who brought him in."
"Yes, because the point was to keep Druitt in Ludlow, which couldn't happen if any of the Shrewsbury officers fetched him to the custody suite there.
So once the paedophile message gets sent, someone starts monitoring things, waiting for the right moment for an arrest, and 19 days later, there's Uncle Bob. Ruddock does what he's told to do, to fetch Ian Druitt, and then he's got out of the way as well."
Havers was staring down at the photos that they'd laid beneath all of the documents.
"But how?" she asked. "We know he made phone calls to the local pubs, but that was pure chance that he'd need to do it. And calling round to the pubs isn't going to take long enough for someone else to sneak in and kill Druitt anyway. Unless, of course, those phone calls were a fly in the ointment, something he had to take care of before the main event of poke, grab and whatever in the car park. But with who?"
Linley looked at her, an eyebrow raised, waiting for her to work it out, which she did quickly.
"Someone who's made an arrangement with him along the lines of, 'Tonight's our night, so be ready for me, you big hunk of man-flesh.' So she clears the way and Druitt's alone while she and Ruddock are panting and heaving in the car, giving someone else a chance to kill him."
She tapped her lip, frowning, and then went on with,
"But that means that Ruddock..."
"He's left in a position he can't possibly defend, believing that Druitt killed himself while he, Ruddock, was outside in the patrol car.
Bonking someone he can't want anyone to know he's bonking. Which means as far as the night Druitt died is concerned, our bloke Ruddock's been telling the truth. He's just not giving us the name of the woman involved. Bloody hell, sir. He's not falling on his sword to be a gentleman, is he? He's falling on his sword because he probably worked it all out directly it happened. And if he makes a wrong move now, which is pretty much a move in any direction, isn't it, he's done for, because he knows what happened, and he also knows there's not a shred of evidence for it."
"So it's easier for the PCSO just to go along and agree it was a suicide. I dare say he was in a panic enough when he rang 999, because at first he probably thought it was a suicide, until he put everything together.
But now everything's falling apart. No wonder he's been making all those calls to Worcester."
"No wonder indeed." Havers looked at the items on the bed, then back at him.
"But where the hell does that take us, sir? We've not moved an inch. We don't have evidence."
Linley picked up two of the photos and held them side by side. He said, "That's not quite it, Barbara. We do have evidence. It's here somewhere. We just have to find it."
Wandsworth, London. Isabel hadn't intended to take another day. Of course, she hadn't actually intended to take the previous day either, but things had got away from her, as happened occasionally in life. In her case, one thing had simply led to another until going into work was out of the question, and leaving a message declaring illness was the only available alternative. Upon first rising from bed, she'd felt herself fully recovered from all previous physical difficulties. It was far earlier than her normal time to be up and about, and she considered this a positive sign. She'd gone to the kitchen and started the water for coffee, pausing first to pour her morning orange juice, dressed with just a touch of vodka. She downed this, but afterwards she felt, oddly, not quite 100%. It was, she reckoned, a case of not having had a decent meal in at least 48 hours. With this on her mind, she decided an egg was in order. She'd always enjoyed a soft-boiled egg accompanied by granary bread, lightly toasted. So she took a pot and an egg and did her bit with them on the cooktop. The bread was a tiny problem, in that mould had established a foothold on one side of it, but she merely cut that off and popped it into the toaster. By that time the water for her coffee had boiled, and as she'd already done her bit with the coffee beans, she saw to that next. She paused, then. Another orange juice sounded good. It tasted just a bit off to her, so she helped it out with another splash of vodka, and then a lovely cup of coffee. She'd been doing quite well with it all. She'd been doing positively grand. She'd forgotten to time the egg, but a glance at the kitchen clock told her it had probably been in the water long enough, and anyway the bread was toasted and buttered and waiting. It was the egg that did her in. When she tapped it round the top and lifted the shell, she saw that she'd miscalculated. The egg was so undercooked that dipping her spoon into it brought forth only a slithering mess. At the sight of this, her insides did a flip-flop that not even a large bite of toast, quickly taken and just as quickly chewed and swallowed, could cope with. Everything rose. Orange juice, coffee, toast. She ran to the bathroom and began vomiting. What followed was a headache, which she hadn't had upon waking, but which, after sicking up her aborted breakfast, she had in throbbing, blinding spades. It wasn't something 2, 4, or 20 paracetamol would be able to cure, but she was determined to get past it on willpower alone in order to get herself to work that day. She needed a lie down first, though, so she staggered to her bed and lowered herself, whispering that this was mind over matter and the matter in question was merely a collection of blood vessels inside her brain. She turned on her side and clutched a pillow to her stomach. 10 minutes, she thought. But that didn't do it, and Isabel knew there was only one way out of her physical ailments. It involved vodka. She told herself that surely she was enough of a woman to master this situation. It took an effort of will to get into the kitchen, but she managed it. She calculated that a mere few shots of Grey Goose would not lead to another day of oblivion, so she had them. When the phone call came, it awakened her. She saw the time. More than 2 hours had passed. Her first thoughts took her to the Met, Dorothea Harriman, Hillier, and Judy with an eye, despite the fact that she was not yet terribly late for work. She swung to a sitting position, felt her stomach heave, and grabbed her mobile. It wasn't anyone from New Scotland Yard, however. It was Bob. He said, "No need to panic, Isabel, but something's happened to Lawrence." She pressed her fingers to her temples. She knew that she had to sound normal. She said, "What's going on?" A pause. Then, "He's taken something of a tumble at school, and we've brought him to A&E. At least I've brought him. Sandra's with James. He was rather upset, as you can imagine."
"A&E? God, is he broken?"
That wasn't at all what she meant. She clutched one hand beneath her chin as if this would make her words come out properly. Another pause. This one was longer before Bob said, "He's managed to give himself a hairline fracture of the skull. He was going at things a bit rough. Well, he's a boy, after all, and he fell from one of the flintstone walls on the edge of the property, where he wasn't meant to be in the first place. He was unconscious. Oh, Christ! But that was brief. They rang for an ambulance, and here we are." What to say or do, when her words weren't coming out correctly and she could barely move from her bed? She said, "Shall I—" He said, "He's going to be fine. We're meant to watch him closely over the next several weeks and definitely keep him quiet, but there's nothing they can do beyond let his skull heal up."
"Oh, God."
"The thing is, Isabel, he's asking for you. He's got himself into quite a state about it. Very unlike Lawrence, I know, as one would expect this more of James, but he's calling for you.
At first I thought he meant Sandra, of course.
Of course, she thought,
because he was asking for Mummy, which is generally what both boys call her, as you know, but when she came to A&E he made it perfectly clear that he wants you. She was meant to jump to her feet. She was meant to go to him at once. Nothing was meant to stop her. She knew that, just as she knew she was fully incapable of doing anything at all. She said,
"Oh, Bob, I'm so... Can you say him... Tell him..."
"You've been drinking, haven't you?" he asked sharply. "You at work?" "No, you can't be. Of course you can't be."
"I haven't. I'm ill. I think it's flu. I've been sick, and now my head..."
"Isabel, stop it. Just bloody stop it."
"Please. Please tell... I'm going to be there. Please tell him Mummy'll come to him as soon as she's able."
"And when might that be?" He didn't wait for a reply, and clearly he didn't want one. "I'm not making excuses for you. He's not stupid. Neither is James."
"Bob. Bob. At least put him on the phone."
"Have you any idea what you sound like? I've no intention of allowing him to hear you like this."
"But tell him..."
"I'm telling him nothing. Get yourself together, Isabel. When you finally do, you can tell him yourself." He rang off, and she was left calling out his name, asking for Lawrence, asking for James, declaring she was well and fit and on her way, even as she knew she could no more drive to Kent than could she fly there. She sank back onto the bed.
She would. She would. She would, she told herself. She just needed rest. Another day.
She rang the Met and was able to leave a message because, thankfully, Dorothea either wasn't there yet or was not at her desk. Then, because she could do nothing else, she went to the kitchen. She staggered there. Her head was thundering and her limbs were quaking. Upset, she thought. Worried, she thought. Lawrence there in A&E with a fractured skull, crying for his Mummy, and of course she was beside herself with concern, which was all this was. When she took up the vodka, her reason for doing so was clear. She needed it to soothe the worries, to make herself ready to go to her son, to be whole for once instead of someone who had to pretend every second of the day that... No, no, that was not it. She would eat. No, she would drink. No, coffee would help her, and then she could get on with life as it was meant to be lived, which was not how she'd been living it. She drank from the bottle another time, and she told herself that was it. That was all she would have. But the worries got to her, and the fact that she couldn't go to him when she was meant to go to him, because she was, after all, the mother who loved him, who'd born him, who'd changed those nappies and fed him from her breast. And did Sandra do that? Did she even know what it was to have a child, two children, growing inside, and then clawing their way out with so much pain and suffering, and the only way ever to deal with the pain and with the suffering and with everything else that ate at her like some alien embedded in her soul? She had reasons, not excuses. And there were a thousand of them, and no one could take them from her, and no one ever would. She was conscious when the bell went on her door. She was in the sitting room, and she hadn't dressed, and it was true she'd been drinking, but she was fully conscious. Still, she knew she couldn't answer that bell. Nor could she answer the knocking that followed a third ring. Then it came to her that it was Bob. Of course it was Bob. He was showing mercy, and he'd come to fetch her. All she needed was a very quick shower, and she would be ready, and she'd swear to him anything he wanted her to swear to, just to show her gratitude for coming into London to take her to their son. Only, she made it to the door, and by the grace of God she did not open it. But it had been fixed with a fish-eye peephole, and when she looked through it, what came upon her was a horror she never expected to feel, not with her life under her own command, as it had been for so very long. For standing there in all her workplace finery was Dorothea Harriman, and as she called out Isabel's rank in her habitual fashion, she didn't look like someone who intended to stop knocking any time soon. Ludlow, Shropshire. They studied the photographs of Ian Druitt's dead body every which way to Saturday night and beyond. Barbara decided she could have drawn both the body and the scene of death from memory when Linley finally called a halt to things. He took up two photos, put the rest into the folder in which they'd been stored, and removed his specs. He said, "We need some air. Come along, although you'll have to lead, as I've no idea how we actually reached this room." She did the honours, snatching up her shoulder bag and snaking her way downstairs, through fire doors and along corridors. When they reached the lobby at last, Peace on Earth was behind reception, and he took them in with a glance that
to Barbara, looked like a knowing one. Man-woman hotel, in addition to several hours' disappearance of man and woman into the depths of said hotel, apparently led to a single conclusion in his experience. That, she thought, was a bloody good laugh. She almost told Linley, but she wasn't sure his delicate sensibilities could handle the horror of it, so she let him lead the way out of the hotel. He walked in the direction of the castle. She had a sinking feeling that her knowledge of kings, queens, and battles royal was about to undergo an expansion. She headed him off by saying, "It's the Plantagenets, sir, the whole bleeding kettle of them. I can't keep them straight." He paused and turned to her. "What are you talking about, Sergeant?"
"That!"
Here she pointed at the castle. "That's where we're going, isn't it? The dungeon, the keep, the bailey, the whatever?" He looked from her to the castle, back to her. He said, "Havers, often I wonder what in God's name you actually take me for. Although," and here she could see he was attempting not to smile, "I'm impressed with your knowledge of castles."
"Don't be. It comes from romance novels. Damsels in the dungeon having their bodices ripped and the like. Plus, I've got the Princess Bride on video. My name is Inigo Montoya and all that. I could probably quote the whole film."
"Ah, I'm nonetheless quite impressed. As before, however, come along." He did cross the street to the castle, but he chose a bench at the base of the castle wall. There were people round and about, but most of them were walking dogs or airing toddlers in pushchairs. They offered something to look at besides the range of buildings across the street. Linley handed her one of the photos he'd brought with him. "What occurs to you, Sergeant?" She studied it. The crime scene photographer had documented every inch of the office in which Druitt had died, and this particular photo took in a corner of it. There, a yellow plastic chair of the stackable variety lay on its side. Above it was an empty bulletin board with lighter patches on it where notices and such had hung. Next to it was the office window. Only part of this was visible, and its Venetian blinds were tilted upwards.
"The blinds," she said. "No one outside the room could see in. But didn't we already talk about this? As an item to pin something on someone, there's no value at all. Anyone could have put them in that position."
"Completely true. Anything else?" She looked closer to see if there was something she'd missed, like, she wasn't sure what, although a declaration of someone's guilt scratched into the lino would have gone down a treat. She said,
"Since there's just the chair and the bulletin board."
"Yes. What strikes you?"
"About?"
"The chair."
"You mean that it's overturned?"
"I mean that it's in the room at all. The other piece of furniture was a desk, as you recall."
"Right, but no one had put Druitt into an office to hold him but not give the bloke a chair."
"Agreed."
"So you mean..."
She looked back at the picture and then at Linley.
"You mean this chair, don't you?"
She turned the photo round to another angle. She could feel Linley watching her, and she knew there had to be something he'd seen. But looking for blood or hairs or fibres or anything else was getting her nowhere, since, aside from blood, which wasn't present anywhere, the rest wouldn't be visible in a photograph. She thought back to her visits to the Ludlow Nick, both with Linley and earlier without him. When she did so, she understood what he was asking her to see, and she felt chagrined that she hadn't caught it immediately.
"When you and I met with Ruddock," she said as she recalled the PCSO's actions that day, "we met in the old lunchroom. Well, he and I met the first time I was there, but there weren't three chairs, so he had to get another for you."
"Indeed," Linley said.
"He rolled a chair in there for you. That's what you're getting at, aren't you, sir? But what's that mean? The desk chair could have come from anywhere."
Linley took the picture from her and studied it, saying, "It could have done, yes. And it's not the desk chair itself. That particular chair Ruddock offered me that's of interest here, Barbara. It's the lack of desk chair in this office or this picture."
"I see that, but it could have been removed, just like Ruddock removed the chair from wherever to give to you."
"I dare say it was removed," Linley said. "The question we might ask ourselves is why it was replaced with this other."
"We could do," Barbara said. "But that's thin on the ground, isn't it? I mean, the other's more comfortable, the one on rollers. But who wants a potential paedophile to be comfortable anyway?"
"I don't disagree. There's that to be argued, a case of, let's not make this easy on him, but that presupposes the PCSO knew why he was fetching Ian Druitt to the station, and we've learned he didn't know the reason."
"Or he says he didn't know.
There's that as well." He put the photo back into the folder, and he brought out the other he'd taken from Barbara's room. This, Barbara saw, was of Druitt's supine body, the ligature removed and lying on the floor post the PCSO's attempt to save him. Barbara looked from the photo to Linley and back to the photo. She was about to ask him what was next when he told her, "Let's arrange to speak to the pathologist, Sergeant. If we missed something, as we did when it comes to the chair, she might have done also." Colebrookdale, Shropshire.